on culture by Adorno. I suppose I should say that of all theorists that we're reading in the module, Adorno is my kind of desert island one. He's certainly the one that I, as you can see how good looking he is, and so he's the theorist that I most like to work with, because he seems to be so profoundly useful. Although it's interesting that none of the kinds of conclusions that Adorno reaches are remotely satisfactory, it seems to me that you what's very difficult is to go along with Adorno and then get off the train at some point. I think it's hard to get off the Adorno train once you allow him an inch of space. He then occupies your whole mind, and it's very difficult to. You can point to the moments at which there are palpable weaknesses in his work, a deep Eurocentrism, for instance, a failure to take the pressure of the critical impulses in popular culture generally, kind of the obvious conflations and reductionism that are involved in if you think that that fascism, monopoly capitalism, and Stalinism are effectively the same thing. That is such a broad stroke that it fails to make things that we might regard are necessary kinds of distinctions. And particularly in the 1960s, as Adorno was nearing the end of his life, he lives from 1903 to 1969, his failure to understand the ways in which I think critical impulses were springing up pretty much everywhere. So let's say the women's movement, the drive throughout the world for decolonization, for instance, jazz as a musical form, popular music generally, all of these things that Adorno deplored kind of, you know, in a blanket way. New cinema, for instance, he had a kind of brief interest, I think, in the new German cinema of the 1960s, but in general, if you think of the kinds of critical filmmaking that was beginning to develop in the 60s, so many critical cultural movements that Adorno wasn't interested in. So all of those things considered, I nevertheless feel that he's a figure of tremendous importance. I think we can situate him relative to Lukács, for instance, who we've looked at, and Benjamin. Think of the dates of those two, that Lukács lives from 1885 to 1971, much so longer life than Adorno's, born 18 years before Adorno, and Benjamin also 1892 to 1940, so dies early, but also born 11 years before Adorno. And I think this explains one of the important differences between their work and his, that for Lukács especially, the events of 1917, the Russian Revolution, the Hungarian Revolution also for Lukács, of course he was a Hungarian, even though the Hungarian Revolution was brutally truncated, but that sense of the First World War as a crisis of intellectualism, and then the ferment after that, very much for Lukács as a young man, but Adorno was only 10 years old at the time, and so that sense of events around 1915 and so on, not so important for him. For him, much more important are what happens to the Russian Revolution, which is that it becomes petrified, becomes Stalinized. Fascism in Germany, his home country, and anti-Semitism, and then in America, where he goes eventually in exile in the 1940s, and stays until just after the war, monopoly capitalism and sort of Americanization, understood in the sense of a worldwide face of capitalism, which Adorno deplored. So of course, Benjamin never lives after the Second World War, and Lukács does, but in a strange way, Lukács living in the East, and trying to stay alive, trying not to be sent to a camp, but Lukács' strange movement between a kind of a Marxist position which is flexible, and the more orthodox forms required of Soviet system intellectuals. Lukács and Adorno clash in the post-war period quite notably. For our purposes, Adorno begins, in fact, where Benjamin and where Lukács also begin with the stuff that we've looked at before, the idea of the commodity fetish, and particularly that notion of the Lukács, it's a very powerful question, how far is commodity exchange able to influence the total inner and outer life of society? And you can already see Adorno's answer in some way to that question. How far? All the way, is his sense. Adorno uses these terms like the fully administered world, for instance. And the idea that there is no remainder, in some sense. Of course, I think one of the tricks or one of the difficult things in reading Adorno is to understand his work as a provocation. We can put it this way. He says at one point, talking about psychoanalysis, he says in psychoanalysis nothing is true except the exaggeration. I think in Adorno's own work as well, understand Adorno's work as exaggerated for effect. So the moment he says the fully administered world or the totally reified world, we have the immediate question that comes up for us, which is, what about you then? In other words, how does Adorno theorize himself? And he does talk about this at some points. He speaks about a lucky accident that has prevented him, as it were, from falling into, from being sort of commodified or being taken up by the culture industry. But that's not a sociological theory, a lucky accident. I mean, what kind of explanation is that? So it's best to understand Adorno as constantly warning us that we're in the 11th hour, that we're in the 11th hour and the 59th minute and the 59th second, that midnight is just in front of us for Adorno, even if he says midnight has dawned. That's not, I think, the way in which we can make sense of his work. There are fabulous moments in Adorno where he will describe a world so unremittingly bleak and taken out. But you have to laugh, as it were, or else just slit your wrists would be the alternative. Perhaps my very favourite of these is where he's quoting from. He's talking about Beckett, who was his. Adorno likes very, very few 20th century cultural producers. In literature after the Second World War, probably there's only one, and that's Beckett. Everybody else is tainted, but Beckett has it right. He says that, he quotes a fragment from Beckett, and he says, the only lingering hope, says Beckett, is that there will be nothing anymore. Which is, imagine that, that's what, and then the next sentence is the one that always kills me, because it says, this too Beckett rejected. Which I find remarkable. You reject even that. I mean, what is left, as it were, after this moment? He will focus on the fact, for instance, that in Waiting for Godot, or is it in Endgame? The two parents are put in dustbins, and so on. Is that where Nell and Nag spend it? And he will say, this is a realistic description of the way in which capitalist society treats the aged, he says. He wanted to write a book on Beckett, and he never got around to it at the end of his career. But he writes a really wonderful essay called "How," I think it's called "Trying to Understand Endgame," and it's a tremendous essay where he's pulling Beckett away from the existentialist readings of him that were so influential in the 1950s. So he's particularly interested in many of his writings in the degree to which cultural production has been subordinated to the logic of the market and integrated into production at large. Something that we've emphasized quite a lot in the module already so far, the sense in which what cultural production is in many of its aspects or many of its dimensions, it is commodity production nowadays. And one sees this, I suppose, most notably in the most popular of the arts, in, let's say, popular music or in film, for instance. Film production is commodity production to a significant extent, and it has to sell. And Adorno is constantly playing with the opposition, if you like, between a culture which is built to sell, or made to sell, and a culture which isn't like that, which defines itself in terms of autonomy and which is really interested in the idea of autonomy. Of course, autonomy, where culture is concerned, is a marginal practice. So Adorno is always trying to pull elite cultural forms away from the charge of the very elitist. My sense is that it's important to understand Adorno as as arguing for an anti-elite elitism, as it were, if that makes sense, or that not all forms of elite culture are elitist, he's suggesting. And you can see by his own tastes in music, for instance, the emphasis on serialism, on atonality, that music which can be incorporated, the kind of music that you could put as a background music in elevators or in stores, for instance, for Adorno is music that has lost any critical function that it might have had. Historically, it's quite an interesting point that he makes, that he says that up until Mozart is a key figure for him, so end of the 18th century, we always seem to come back to this end of the 18th century as it were, as a place in which certain changes happen. But in the that's the last time, according to Adorno, at which popular arts and serious, if that's an alternative topic, popular arts and serious arts coincided. Obviously they do in Shakespeare, for instance, 100 years before that, or 150 or whatever it would be. So in the 19th century, the two paths diverge, serious and popular, as it were, autonomous and integrated. And after that, Adorno takes the side of the autonomous, but not to argue for an idea of art for art's sake or anything like that, as we'll see. So he suggests that that the term culture industry is a better term than mass culture or popular culture, which are terms that are often used. Popular culture creates the idea, obviously, of a culture which is popular, that it gives the people what they want, as it were. And Adorno is arguing always that mass culture is rather a kind of a horrible trick that is played on the people. It's what's visited on them. And the most relentless and uncomfortable aspect of this for Adorno is how we are preformed, or how we are manufactured in some sense, how we are socialized into wanting this. So for Adorno, the two sides come together. That basically, as he would put it, as he wouldn't put it because he doesn't tend to use vulgar terms, this shit is dumped on us. And even worse, as it were, we are manufactured to want it. It's a horrible logic, which he also plays out through psychoanalytic categories of masochism and sadism, for instance, when he speaks of laughter in the cinema, and he says that laughter in the cinema is sadistic, that we're laughing at rather than laughing with. He puts it in one place, fun, he says, is a medicinal bath. The culture industry never ceases to prescribe it. And so, you know, that's you can see him already pushing that that argument very strongly. The masses are not primary but secondary. They are an object of calculation, an appendage of the machinery. The customer is not king, not its subject, but its object, is the argument. I was thinking of this when I was just watching, and you've probably been reading about the, or some of you may have, the kind of controversy over Gillette's new brand. Has anyone followed this debate about Gillette? You know, Gillette's famous slogan is that the best a man can get. But they've changed this with the newest one, and you can just look them up. It's the best a man can be. And so here, and the ads all show, they show Gillette responding to Me Too. So that over and over again, there are men who intervene when other men touch women's bottoms or put their hand on women's shoulders and mansplain to them, etc. Or intervene when two kids are fighting. So it's quite extraordinary how the language constantly says something like, we've put up with this too long, it says. The best a man can be is a sensitive man, a post-Me Too man. And then, you know, at the end you get the Gillette logo. So, I mean, it's that whole thing. I was very struck by one of the commentators who said that it's no longer enough for Gillette to manufacture a product. They said, I mean, you've seen all this stuff before in the module. It has to have a purpose. And I was thinking, well, what's the purpose of a razor blade? It surely is to cut. But no, the purpose of Gillette, of course, which is a brand, is not the razor blade at all. It's to represent a certain kind of masculinity. Just look up the best a man can get. You'll get about five or six of these ads, which are being broadcast very widely across American television anyway. And you can see for yourself the way it's going. So the customer is not subject but object, and that sense of the idea that in the 1950s, at least, the suggestion is, because I think we have to distinguish today where there is niche marketing in some way, so things begin to change. But we're talking about the both the monopolization of the supplying networks on the one hand, and then the massification or standardization of the product, and the standardization then of the people who consume the products. I think today things are somewhat different, and perhaps you can see this in terms of the, if you think of popular musical, from 1900 till about 1970, let's say, what one saw was the steady monopolization of the big corporations. So that by the 1970, all of the music that we would be listening to was marketed by about five companies, you know, EMI, or whatever the five would be. There were only five. Same thing in the news, for instance. There used to be 60 or 70 news outlets by 1970. There were only about three or four. But then what happened was the development of, as it were, niche markets. I think particularly if you think about new wave music, for instance, or punk music, in the way in which labels like Rough Trade, for instance, emerged. And this created a crisis for the corporates. They needed in some way to be able to neutralize the threat represented by these new outlets that were actually appealing to wide numbers. The way of doing it was, of course, to bring them on board. And you see this, for instance, with, let's say, Fine Line, or the various kinds of studios that now appear. If you look at any interesting film, I would say, it's usually simultaneously marketed and distributed or funded in some way by, on the one hand, a small outfit, presumably young people, progressive thoughts about film, incorporated into a much larger one, Disney or something like this. So that all of the big corporates now have their little kind of experimental arms. The same thing true music was, so that Warner or WEA own Rough Trade or the various kinds of subsidiaries. So each of the corporates now has its own niche markets. In some ways, this comes, I think, after Adorno. But he's talking in a context of of Levittown, let's say. So this is the production of mass housing in the 1950s. And Adorno's suggestion that the culture industry is in some way responding or is a representation of this, intentionally integrating its consumers from above. Levittown, one of many towns or cities built after the war to house the aspirational working class. And the sense of, so all of these houses the same, etc. I have here a video which is from a very interesting series that there were eight seasons. I think it may be just too early for you because the last one ended in 2012. It's Genji Kohan's Weeds. Has anyone seen or caught up with Weeds? It was appeared initially on Showtime and was a comedy starring Mary Louise Parker and dealing with a woman who's a suburban Californian woman living in a one of these Levittown kind of, except an upmarket Levittown called Agrestic. And as the clips go on, as the series goes, Agrestic, when we see the kind of the town logo, it changes into various kinds of things, Majestic, Regrestic is my favorite. But she gets involved, she's in living in Southern California, her husband dies, he had been involved in growing weed, and she takes over his business, basically, and soon becomes involved in heavy kind of narco-trafficking across the border with Mexico, gets involved with sort of major Mexican drug dealers. And the film has this, the series has this peculiarly, it's absolutely terrifying. She's trying to destroy the lives of her children. As where she, you know, she succeeds quite well. One becomes a policeman. One becomes a drug dealer. Is there a difference? Just extraordinary kinds of ways in which questions of suburban living, a certain kind of privilege, drug dealing, the law, feed in it. It's a very, very funny, very bleak, sardonic thing, and each episode begins with a singer singing Malvina Reynolds's great early folk critical song called Little Boxes. In season one, it's mostly Malvina Reynolds, you see, but in season two, they bring in other musicians to sing in these. So Elvis Costello appears, Amy Mann, about sort of 50 different singers. What's his name? Billy Bob Thornton appears in a particular version of it. Angelique Pidjo, the Ivoirian singer, and so on, each singing the same things. And so this is, I think, the one I've got. This is the opening credits of Weeds. I think this is the one where Regrestic appears. But so it's substantially the same each week. But it seemed to me that it goes to the Adornian moment quite well.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes of the sun. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people and the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes, and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
So, eight series of that. It is a very funny program, I think. So, the logic of cultural production, Adorno says, is the logic of commodity production. And again, nothing is true except the exaggerations. By definition, it seems to me that isn't true. If one thinks, for instance, of Adorno's own writing, if one thinks of the of how important it is to so many cultural producers, artists, poets, dancers, etc., that their work be different, be governed by a different logic, an artisanal logic, for instance, the people who attempt to produce a kind of culture based on a different aesthetic. And yet we understand, if you understand that as tendentially true, it's a tendency. This is where we're heading, Adorno says. He says it as it is, but I take it that he means it's becoming. So that the what's new, he says, is not production for the market, but the direct and undisguised primacy of an economic calculus. And the ability, the fact that we now talk admiringly, as it were, of culture as capital is something whose fairly recent development we have to take on board. Here are the top grossing movies of 2018, and I have to say I'm sufficiently Adornian to be pleased that I've seen none of these. So the good test of being Adorno is if you perhaps you see none of these but have an ability to critique all of them, as it were. That would be the Adornian position. But I mean, you can see the stupendous sums of money that are involved there. Also notice the monopolization of the distributors. Disney, I mean, I looked at the top 20, and something like 12 or 13 of the top 20 are Disney films. And also, I suppose, for Adorno, also the genre is important. The sense in which, as he says, he says two things. He says, every film I see makes me more stupid, is the one statement which I like. But also that that films are all identical. And what could that possibly mean, as it were? I mean, and we begin to understand what he means, but not at the level of the details. The moment you focus on the detail, the moment you actually read any of these films, you see that Adorno is wrong. But if you're thinking in terms of this is a tendency, you can see how he also might be, quote, right to a significant degree. So by industry, he says, is not meant principally the production process, although here we would describe that. Artisanal or individualized forms of production persist. The standardization of the thing itself, he says, the rationalization of distribution techniques, industrial more, he says, in the sociological sense, in the incorporation of industrial forms of organization, even when nothing is manufactured. And then we get a discussion in Adorno of the concept of technique. And I think he means by this also what we would understand as form, in some sense. What is the technique of production? And there's a way in which Adorno, what he's arguing is, in some sense, the process of production itself is entering into the technical aspects, the formal aspects of works of culture. So that the works of culture become in some ways exemplifications of what the technique can do. If you think, for instance, of the role of special effects in big budget movies, for instance, the way in which the movies are governed by what special effects. So what happens to conception of the work of art as a whole, where one of its aspects, that is to say, the special effect or the ability, CGI, for instance, or alternatively, just the ability to convey the impression of space. I mean, I think the example I have here is from The Martian, and this is the trailer of Martian. The question would be not whether this is an interesting take on this in some sense, but just the ability to what degree is the film merely an expression or a registration or an exemplification of technique, where technique is purely formal, is purely abstract. Technique has nothing to do with what we used to call cultural production. I take it that that's what Adorno is interested in here.
Every human being has a basic instinct to help each other out. If a hiker gets lost in the mountains, people coordinate a search. If an earthquake levels the city, people all over the world send emergency supplies. This instinct is found in every culture, without exception.
At around 4:30 a.m., our satellites detected a storm approaching the Ares III mission site on Mars. The storm had escalated to severe, and we have no choice but to abort the mission. But during the evacuation, astronaut Mark Watney was killed.
I'm entering this log for the record. This is Mark Watney, and I'm still alive, obviously. I have no way to contact NASA or my crewmates, but even if I could, it would take 4 years for another manned mission to reach me, and I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. So, in the face of overwhelming odds, I'm left with only one option. I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this. Okay, let's do the math. I gotta figure out how to grow 4 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can...
That was actually a film I have seen. So what I'm trying to get you to see in Adorno terms is how the film is driven by its special effects. I mean, they are tremendous when you see it, you know, in a big screen with surround sound and all these kinds of things. But that sense in which the film is driven, or the production of the film is driven by one of its aspects, the leading aspects, the central aspect here. Adorno spends a lot of time talking about let's say how we would interpret a Beethoven symphony, for instance, or form of music that that he regards as being a totality. I mean, if you think of particularly of Wagner as the Wagner is the great theorist of the late 19th century who speaks of the work of art as a totality, conceptual, linguistic, musical, pictorial, but that particular sense of the work of art as a whole, which begins to come apart, doesn't it, at the end of the 19th century. Modernism, you could say, marks one moment at which the idea of a total work of art collapses to be replaced by fragments. But very often in the modernist artwork, the fragment is given to us. Let's say in Gregor Samsa, in the Kafka story, for instance, the fragment stands, for Adorno at least, as a kind of a something that's broken loose and exists as a kind of as a screaming refusal, as something which protests, which laments. But no longer does the fragment have that effect. The fragment now can become the entire work. So that one wouldn't speak of the idea of the work of art as a whole in describing something like the Martian for Adorno. That's the wrong term to be used. So from Avatar also, where again very much the special effects were the film. Adorno's suggestion of the movement from what used to be called culture, again, his notion, to entertainment, where if entertainment is in some sense what structures us in to compulsory consumption, then entertainment is the prolongation of work under lay capitalism, sought by those who want to escape the mechanized labor process so they can cope with it again. Etc. So just after images of the work process itself. And this he contrasts, so this is one model he suggests. So I'm thinking I always hate this idea of play hard, in a properly Adornian sense, for instance, because it isn't meant play well or play fully within the kind of rigors of the game. as it were. I mean, one wants to play tennis or cricket or whatever it is hard, that's to say, you know, to give yourself to it. But that's not quite the same thing as what's being described here. It's that counterpart, work hard, play. Is there a difference between the two hearts there, or productive things to do in your free time? If they're productive, according to which logic are they productive? Is time then free? And as we know in the essay that we're reading today, free time is not free, it almost suggests. What would free time be? Is a question that he poses. What might it? And of course, there isn't one answer to that question. There are as many answers for Adorno as there are people. There have to be, because Adorno is very much opposed to the kind of one-size-fits-all mentality. So that free time could only be self-defined. But it has to be self-defined in opposition to compulsory norms, in some sense, or semi-compulsory norms. He spends... one of his funniest essays for me is one in which he... he talks about the ham radio specialist. This is, of course, way before your time, even before mine, but in which usually men, actually, would sit, always, I would say men, would sit there and would patiently make a radio. And you know, as Adorno says, why don't you make it when you can go buy it quite cheaply? It's not very much. I mean, what's involved in actually following the instructions? So painting by numbers, as it were. And he has this fabulous passage where he says, let's consider this person. You know, he works hard at this, he's not very successful. And then in a lovely phrase, where I don't know where it comes from in Adorno's work, he says, he has no luck with girls. He says, so you have to imagine the ham radio person is sitting there, a nerd is being described by Adorno in some sense. And this peculiar sense is the nerd for Adorno is on this reading at least, is not the free thinking, the one who thinks. You know, the deep thinker. The nerd is one who thinks entirely in line with what is to be thought, as it were, so that you end up by taking tremendous pleasure from producing something that is given from the beginning. And for Adorno, that is a very, very sad fate. That's why he talks about this. And so he speaks about... the suntan, for instance, again, extremely funny, it seems to me, or alternatively, jitterbugging. He gets quite ballistic about the craze for jitterbugging, which is a kind of jazz dance, isn't it, in the 1920s and 30s. And all he sees is these people sort of shaking in time to the music that he hates in any case. But he describes a sense of this, the uniformity of dance is what he dislikes most. He contrasts this with an idea of an older form of culture. Culture used in accommodating itself to human beings, at the same time to protest against the petrified relations under which they lived, thereby honoring them. And think about what's involved here, that sense of in accommodating itself to human beings. The terrible logic of Kafka's fiction in some way for Adorno is that you know, it's unearthly, it's otherworldly, but it's human scale, and always the tragedies are measured against a kind of a human fate. And yet, because it's obviously a protest, it's a, you know, these are novels or texts of alienation, of isolation, of dismay. You know, think of Beckett also, think of those scenes in Happy Days when Winnie is the first half of the play, she's up to her stomach in sand, by the second half she's up to her neck. It's human size, it's a she mutters inanities for an hour and a half, as it were, which take on a tragic meaning, because you know, we can't help but read the stage sets as being a narrative. First she was up to her waist, now she's up to her neck. We know where Act Three is going, and so on. And she's just talking. And we have to see this talking as protesting again, even though she's not saying anything that's a protest. So I'm trying to think of various kinds of works which are human size shaped or something, and which merely in their articulation seem, even if they're not, it's nothing to do with what they say, says Adorno. We measure these things in terms of form for him, culturally. The example that I came up with is. Just a contemporary example is Meredith Monk. Does anyone know Meredith Monk's music? So she's a singer, avant-garde singer. A great album called Dolmen Music, for instance. So this is actually, before we get to Monk, we have a contemporary dance representation of Metamorphosis, which made quite a splash on the American stage a couple of years ago. And we see that the projection is, of course, of the insect, so Gregor Samsa. But that idea of the way in which the human, going back to his language, accommodating itself to human beings, but protests against the petrified conditions, thereby honoring people. That's the Adornian dialectic here. And so I'm just thinking of the way in which voice exists. This is a song called Gotham Lullaby that she sings, and it's very simple. I mean, it's almost like a kind of monochordal piano and Monk's voice. So therefore, by definition, it's small scale. And as it emerges, you begin to hear the voice as a kind of, it's called lullaby, but the voice then becomes, I think, a kind of like a plaint in some sense. At least that's what it seems to me. I mean, I find it the opposite of something that would put me to sleep. In fact, the more I hear it, the sadder it seems to me to become. And I think that's what Adorno understands by what culture does. As distinct from the contemporary form. I mean, you might disagree and think that it's fabulous for falling to sleep.
I'd like to sing an old song for you called Gotham Lullaby.
Ask about the the situation of the work, where the situation refers, I think, not to the context, who is Meredith Monk, what's this about, but in some sense, how do you provide meaning for this work? And I think for Adorno, the brokenness of the work is what would interest him most. For Adorno, the culture, in as he understands it, in the 20th century at least, cannot make us happy. Culture does not console. As he puts it, in fact, at one place, he says, the person, the metaphor he uses is this, the person over whom Kafka's wheels has ridden is forever unconsoled. The moment I found this, I was always tremendously happy because when I was doing graduate work in England, my mother would constantly ask me whether I was happy. And once I discovered Adorno, I could just say something like, "Of course not! What a horrible question that is! You know, but how could I possibly be happy? Have you not read Beckett?" I would say, or something like this. You know, that the purpose of culture was to make you enraged forever, in some ways, because you're always contemplating the gap between what is and what might be, or what ought to be. It's that sense of how do you honor? You can see that Adorno is not that far here from Benjamin, where Benjamin's sense of what history should be is to recover the kind of the trampled hopes of people who have died too young. Whether as a result of atrocity or just in their everyday life, a car accident. In what sense is a car accident, you know, to be understood as being tragic or mournful or something like this? And I think that sense of it's the cultural gaze that gives the answer to that question. For Adorno, culture does not console us. It builds resistance in a broken world. Culture can't fix the world. It's very important not to overstate what culture is for Adorno. Only social action can fix the world. But culture registers more than anything else that the world is broken. And for Adorno, the culture industry, of course, works in exactly the opposite direction. In order to bind us in to consumption, in order to understand that consumption is all that there is, that's how culture operates for Adorno. Okay, I'm not sure how far I'm going to get in this. Let me just emphasize two historical dimensions in Adorno, two ways of thinking about time, if you like. On the one hand, there is universal history, the history of humankind. And he's talking here about, you know, do things get better? because in an important sense, part of the humanist project, part of progressive or historical reason, is built on this idea that we get better. Remember, we talked about this a little bit with the Foucault, where we said Foucault is saying, you know, are we in a more humane world now than the world in which people were tortured and killed? Same kind of question. Adorno's answer to this is quite implacable. I mean, there's that fabulous notion of no universal history leads from savagery to humanity. So we don't go from barbarianism to civilization. But there is a history that goes from the slingshot to the megaton bomb. That's a terrifying prospect. What he's saying here is that I don't believe in this category of universal history. But if you insist, if you really want me to think through universal history, then this is how it goes. And the only thing that happens is that the size of the payload gets ratcheted up. We do much more damage with weapons of mass destruction now than we ever did. We're just as evil as we ever were, but now we can kill more people. Maybe that's what universal history means. But of course, to the degree that Adorno is also a Marxist thinker, he's very interested in the idea of bourgeois history. And in that, precisely in that sense, that capitalism changes the world, which also means that it changes the prospects of the world. That peculiar sense for for Marx, expressed also by Dickens, taken up by others, that the best of worlds and the worst of worlds, and that struggle between the two. What Adorno argues is that for a select group of people under capitalist social relations, and these are the bourgeoisie, the privileged, there's a sense in which a position is reached. Adorno cites this position in the mid-19th century, in which certain people, they are marked by class, by race, and by gender, for him. They're men. They're men of substance. They're men of property. They're men of capital, of educational capital. And they are free. And they are free in a way that no people historically have ever been, he suggests. Not least because their freedom, they seem to imagine that their freedom doesn't require the domination of all the others. In that sense, they're different from all of the kind of feudal aristocracy. And Adorno suggests that these figures, the freedom in these figures, acts as a kind of little, the word he uses is a monad. It acts as a monad, a little bubble, which is self-contained and not the totality, but it acts as a... You can see what universality or what universal freedom might be if you look at these people. It has to involve universalizing privilege. But how do you universalize privilege? By definition, privilege is what is not universal. Some people are privileged, therefore most people are not. Freedom for Adorno is understood as the universalization of privilege, and he suggests that capitalism puts that on the agenda. Of course, capitalism doesn't realize it, but it puts it on the agenda. It puts it on the table, thus creating the problems. And the sadness for Adorno is that when he turns from the 19th century to the 20th, the argument is that what happens is that the particular specificity of that freedom gets leveled off. Standardization and the massification of culture doesn't mean the lifting up of all. It means the leveling down of all. So that freedom becomes a form of impossibility, Adorno suggests, under monopoly capitalism, under fascism, under Stalinism. That's how his argument proceeds. This is why he dislikes contemporary culture. I mean, contemporary in his time, 1950s, 1960s. There's so much more to be said, but I won't say it now. So let's just focus on his two essays tomorrow. The easier one is the free time one, so let's start with that if we can and just talk through that.